amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie Show. It's Saturday, June the 3rd, and I've got Steve with me, and I've got Paul with me. I'm Steve W, and I've got some news from this week in the UK markets. Steve and Paul have got things from everywhere else, mostly in the tech sector, I think. But it's turning into quite a nice day here, weather-wise. Steve, how are things where you are?
Very sunny. I just went out there to feed the bird, Steve, the old man that I am, and pulled up a few weeds while I was waiting for you guys to turn up. And it's very nice and warm up there. It's going to be a lot hotter by the time we get this edited now, which is unfortunate because I've got to go and cut the hedge. So thanks, guys. Yeah, I really appreciate it. Thanks for listening, everyone. How about you, Paul? What's the weather like in wherever you are?
It's nice, as usual. It's getting up to 34 degrees over here. So it's getting hot. But we've had a rough week, actually. Been a bit cloudy, and it's been a bit windy, so haven't been able to surf as much.
Paul is living his best life here, everyone. Meanwhile, Steve and I are reasonably hard at work, I think, at the moment. It's the end of term here, which means two things where I work. One is that it means that there's a vacation period coming up, which will be very nice. The other is it means that before that vacation period, basically everything has to be done. So it means the deadlines are coming round as well. And it's nice to look forward to the end of term and a gap from teaching. I like teaching, but it's nice to have a break as well. But it does mean that all the deadlines start coming up quite quickly. And my students are off their exams at the moment in some cases, which they are finding or challenging. A couple of them have found it was a tough set of questions this year that they were looking at. But stock market, interesting day on Friday for me. Stuff started moving higher quite significantly after I'd basically left it for dead, to be honest. I'd not been looking for most of the week, and then I sort of had a quick look on Friday and then saw, firstly, it had gone down quite a bit until Friday, and then it had gone up quite a bit on Friday. Same for you guys?
That's the difference for me. I'm up about 5.5% this week, so I've had a pretty decent week. I'm closing in on the benchmark after last year's horrendous slip away from it. I ended up about 20 points away from it last year, but this year I'm beating it by about 14 points already and closing that overall gap to, I think I'm within about 6 points of it now. So 6 points of rise. If I'm doing 5.5 in a week, beating the benchmark, I'd be really happy about that. Steve, I'll start posting my portfolio again.
And has that come from a lot of your smaller bets? Because some of your smaller bets have made massive moves recently, I'm guessing.
You haven't been here in a while, Paul. My portfolio has had a bit of a rehaul in the middle of last year. I basically split it in two. I kept all of my larger and mid-cap stuff in my ISA, where I'll be shoving the vast majority of my money, and I split into my capital incinerator pie, which is in my general investment account, and then I basically ran it like that from now on. It means I've still got a lot of stocks, but to be honest with you, I don't look at my capital incinerator pie. I've bought 39 companies in the equivalent amount that I wanted to buy, and then I deleted it off all of my tracking apps, deleted it off Google Finance, and then I haven't looked at it since April. Other than a sneak peek, just because of one of the companies we're going to be talking about was up about 40% this week, and I just had to check how up I was, and it was 150% at the moment, so... Doing very well on that one. Very, very chuffed about it. So, yeah, normally when I'm cheery like this and everyone in the comment section always says the same thing. Market's about to go down. Steve's cheery. I apologise in advance for that.
Yeah, from my memory, that incinerator pie is very polarised at this point. You've got some stocks which have run massive, but in my head, I can think of a couple that... Okta's not doing very well at the moment, is it? I've been seeing...
I bought Okta about 50. Yeah, so yeah. Okta for me is still up, but just not by very much. But I have got some stocks that are like Toast and things like that. They're down quite a bit. They're probably down about 30%. But then I've got shares like Nanox that are up 260%. So it's up overall, strangely, about 2%, which, you know, when you consider the risk involved, probably not worth the effort. But it's doing okay.
So in the main, in our main investment portfolios, I'm guessing the story is very similar to what mine is. Mine has had a brilliant run over the past week. I am now something like 0.4% ahead of my benchmark at the moment. Very, very slimly beating it. In total, I don't know what the year is, but I'm guessing you're the same. It's big tech. It's Amazon, Google. Not Apple for me, but Amazon, Google, and what's the other one I'm missing? That's gone up quite heavily, and
Microsoft in
that's
your
been
case, I think.
Microsoft. Yeah, Microsoft, of course. They've been rushing the portfolio, bringing it higher, and the rest has kind of been stagnant more than anything. There's a couple that have dropped quite heavily. I'm going to go with AT&T and Tyson Foods. The two have dropped quite heavily recently, but the rest is fairly stable. It's these big tech again that are pushing the market up.
Yeah, you're pretty much right about that. I mean, it feels like the sort of occasional wobbles that we had during the pre-interest rate rising stuff. So directly the market got concerned about anything at all. All the kind of active fund managers sold all their small stuff and went and hid in big tech because big tech has pretty strong balance sheets, pretty good earnings, and pretty much operates like defensive stuff, even though strictly it isn't in a defensive sector in most cases. And that seems to be what's going on. I'd be surprised if Steve's smaller cap bets were doing anything much apart from maybe the odd one. I think what he's waiting for is just interest rates to come down, and then I think things will sort of take over a bit more from the middle or the lower end of the market cap scale.
Well, yeah, I've been doing pretty well out of Europe as well, though. So I'm gonna take a little bit of a wider credit for this. I've obviously had ASML done really well for me, and then if we're looking at the Swiss stocks, I've got Straumann, VAT Group, and Sonova that have all done very well as well. So it's not just big tech for me, although I will include Netflix, Amazon, Google, etc., all in my portfolio. Even Salesforce this year has had a pretty good year so far. The only one for me that is not performing is Disney.
Don't ignore big tech. That's essentially. I'm so glad I pivoted a little bit into it, into these high cash flow, and tried to do that because defensive, on the other hand, is very poor at the moment. I'm actually sitting there watching my cyclicals at the moment, just l watching them come down and go, okay, when is going to be the right point that copper starts to take over again? What when do minerals start to recover again, these sorts of things. So I'm kind of looking at that. We'll have to clarify there on the screen. Anybody that's viewing this can see Steve D's cat walking across the screen there. If you're listening, that's not going to sound so good.
Yeah, I'm really sorry about that. She was really desperate to come in for some reason, so I let her in thinking she would just walk under my feet, and she decided to take the Assassin's Creed parkour route. So anyway, she's in the window now. We'll see how we get on.
So, Steve,
Yeah,
what have we
10 o'clock
got
in the morning
today
and Steve's chasing tail already.
then? What have we got
Today,
today?
moving on from discussions of big tech, we're looking at some changes to the UK indices, the FTSE 100 and the FTSE 250, and we've got earnings and general news from Broadcom, which is one of Paul's stocks and not mine or Steve's, Guidewire, which is nobody's stock at the moment, although it used to be one of mine and it might be again, and Salesforce, which is one of Steve's, not one of mine, and I've forgotten whether you own that or not, Paul.
No.
No. Okay, cool. Let's kick things off then with some news from home. So there's changes in the FTSE 100 and the FTSE 250. There's the FTSE 100 is rebalanced or reconstituted or reconsidered, however you want to put it, 4 times a year by one of Steve's companies, I think, FTSE Russell, which is owned by a subsidiary of LSEG, I think, which is part of Steve's portfolio, if I remember rightly. Still, yep, still got it. And here's, well, so each quarter, there's a snapshot date, and on that, any company that meets the criteria gets included in the FTSE 100. Any company that doesn't meet the criteria goes out the door. See if you know what any of the criteria are for being in the FTSE 100.
No idea.
No, okay, so here are the criteria for being included in the FTSE 100. You have to be based in the UK. You have to have revenue growth of between 1.2 and 2.4% on average for the last 10 years.
Wow.
No higher than 2.4%. You must
Setting the
not be a tech
bar.
company, and you must have a Shiller PE ratio between 12 and 20 to. No, I'm kidding. None of those is a criteria. So the FTSE 100 has stuff like Rio Tinto, which, as far as I'm aware, doesn't even know where the UK is. it's none of those things. What you have to be is one of the biggest listed companies. So it's obviously supposed to be the 100 biggest companies on the UK exchanges weighted by market cap. Although if that were the case, we would find we had changes pretty much every quarter as companies 100 and 101 swap rounds. So things would be coming in and going out and so on. So there's a bit of a margin and a window here. So anything that falls outside the top 110 goes out, so you have a kind of 10 place buffer before you fall out, or anything that makes it into the top 90 coming up from below makes its way in. So there's obviously a fair bit of kind of sitting between 90 and 110 where nothing moves to prevent them rebalancing sort of every quarter. But there are some changes this time, and people were looking in the relegation race, as AJ Bell were calling it. I thought this was quite a nice analogy, to be honest. Ocado. Ocado down about 87% since 2021. I had to double check Cathie Wood didn't own it. It's down so much. But she doesn't. And that stock has fallen quite a long way and was flirting with the danger area. AJ Bell compared it to Everton, though, as it kind of got safe on Wednesday, which was the cutoff day. They managed to make their way into, I think, 109th position or something like that to stay safe. But out goes British Land, which is a REIT that we've talked about 4 weeks ago, maybe, on this show. And it's a REIT that is essentially, as far as I can tell, made a bit of a mess. It owns a lot of office buildings. Office buildings are not terribly popular at the moment. But what it's also done is decided to wait for the price of warehouses to go up and then start buying them. And now the price of warehouses is coming down, which has caused them kind of even more damage. There's been a bit of a bursting in the shed bubble, as people are calling it, which I think is quite a good name. And it's one thing if you're a company like Warehouse REIT or Segro or something and you owned these things on the way up and, oh well, they've gone the other way a bit. It's another thing if you're British Land and you didn't own these things on the way up and then you bought them and then they start coming down again. So they make their way out, and in comes a company called IMI Group. Either of you, Steve is shaking his head already. Either of you know anything about IMI Group? I'll tell you why either of you might in a moment. Steve, any thoughts?
I've never heard of them before. No, I just while you were talking, I just pulled up the list to see who the potential additions and deletions was, and I thought, oh, Ocado out and IMI in. I was like, I wonder if I need to Google what IMI is. I wonder if that question's coming. But no, I have no idea.
IMI is a manufacturing company. Steve, you tend to be quite good on those sorts of things, so it might be one that catches your eye. It's about fluid movement and that kind of stuff. It's based in, I was going to say Paul's part of the world. It's not quite Paul's part of the world, and also I don't know where Paul's part of the world currently is. So it's based in Birmingham, so a bit further south, I think, than where Paul is some of the time. Not a million miles from me, actually. But they're a manufacturer. They've been in and out of the FTSE 100 over the course of sort of history, so it's not a big upstart kind of company or anything like that coming up, because FTSE 100 doesn't have big upstart companies. If we have those, we start relegating them out again. Some movements in the 250 as well, though. So in from above goes British Land, and in from below comes the Capita Group, Empiric Student Property, which is a REIT, Me Group, don't know what that is, North Atlantic Smaller Companies Trust, and Tymon, don't know most of those last ones. Out goes ASOS, finally. They've managed to lose so much market cap that they're now falling out the bottom of the 250. Capricorn Energy, a company called Hunting, Tullow Oil, which I've sort of heard mentioned a couple of places, and Videndum. Does that mean we have to stop talking about ASOS now that it's basically moved into the FTSE AIM, or whatever it's called?
That's just a shame. That was a, yeah, that's certainly a bad call. Call it a call. I do own it. I do own a little bit of ASOS, not a ridiculous amount, but yeah, it's that went really, really badly. I think what we were doing during the pandemic is looking at extremely good revenue there and assuming that we were going to make profit. And the retail industry at this point now, I think for the rest of my life, I think I'll be avoiding the main retail industry. I really wanted to look at ABF, Associated British Foods, because it looks brilliant as far as its movement into America. It's going to go semi-online, which I thought was a really, really good move. Something I've been thinking about for them for a good while, a sort of McDonald's drive-through type thing. I know we're talking about ABF, but I think that level of model for Primark is much better than the ASOS model, which is this whole sending back money back and forth, sending products back and forth. It just doesn't, it never made sense to me when when I was buying off them a long time ago. But I think I just saw the revenue and saw people using it during the pandemic, and I went, "Oh, this has got something." And unfortunately, I think a lot of other people have fallen for that as well.
I think both of them are ASOS and Boohoo here. The problem is that they had a long-term plan and they swapped it for a short-term plan to try and appease the fact that the share price is collapsing. And I just think that's a really, really, really bad move. When companies stop looking at 10-year plans to go into America and start doing what ASOS are doing, saying, no, we're just going to focus on our domestic market and we're pulling out of bits of Europe and we're not going to expand any further in America, you just think that sounds like a really, really bad idea, especially as the domestic market is really, really competitive. I mean, ASOS and Boohoo were fierce competition for each other, and now we've got Shein as well coming in and doing all the things that they used to do cheaper, and nobody seems to care about the child labour involved in making Shein's products, so ASOS and Boohoo are immediately out on price here. So yeah, I don't know, I think it's really tough for ASOS and Boohoo, and again, that was something that I had my eye on, and I bought a little bit of it. I took a really quick loss on it when I realised, you know, the CEO was useless, and I think I still ended up losing about 300 quid in it. But I still had an argument with ISA Investor, friend of the show, about that I thought it could turn around. I just didn't want it to turn around with my money. Luckily, he ignored me too and sold it, because I would have, I may have talked him into keeping an absolute dud. So yeah, congratulations to us both. We both lost money on a terrible stock.
Well done. One that sticks out to me on the other side, by the way, coming into the FTSE 250 from below, is Empiric Student Property. I just had a quick look at their share price chart. I haven't actually done this, but I imagine if you overlay this against ASOS, what you will see is two shares going basically the opposite direction for the last 5 years. So they both kind of go along flat together. Then the pandemic happens and student property goes through the floor because everyone's doing remote everything and nobody really wants to do this. And in the case of universities, a sector that I probably know slightly better than I know some other ones, a lot of people found actually the product isn't that bad when you take it online. Universities have always had distance, or not always, but they've a long time had distance learning things, and they've always been a bit of a sideshow. They've always been a basically cash grab because, cool, we can teach these things and they're relatively cheap. Pandemic taught, or the lesson I learned from the pandemic, is that if we really put some thought into it, we can take this product online quite well, and it's not that much work and not much of a kind of deterioration. Where that leaves student property stuff, I would have worried about in 2021, and I would have been entirely wrong, because from then it's come roaring back, not quite at the same rate that Ocado and another pandemic booming thing and ASOS have gone the other way. But that was the one that struck me as interesting, a sort of, in both cases, kind of pandemic unwinding thing, bringing us back to where we were before, and proof that, I don't know, UK stocks and companies will never do anything different ever, other than for a very short period of time.
But is the story in your work still that you're working online, or are your students flooding back to work on site?
Well, we're 100% back on site and in-person stuff, but we're slightly different to most universities in that Oxford tends to own pretty much all of its accommodation and is desperate to let that accommodation to students because that's a way of making money. If you were a university that thought, I'm just going to send our second and third years out into the private sector, so I'm not going to make any kind of accommodation money from them like that, I don't know why you wouldn't have the same incentive to care, I guess. You'd still have your first years in, but second and third years, I guess. There's not the same thing there. And of course, Empiric aren't particularly tied to any university that I know of, and I'm not sure what deals they have with universities. I think they just stick up student flats and let market forces do the rest.
I just had a look at Empiric then. I just pulled it up. The chart, it's been public 10 years, and in 10 years, it's actually down 8%. But obviously, that's not dividend adjusted. You add dividends in, it's actually quite a small yield. It's only about 3% at the moment, so you would assume that's pretty high from where it's been. You would probably only have a very, very small return out of this one. So I don't think there's any strategy involved in picking the 100 losers and the 250 movers. I'm looking through all of these here thinking, God, these things all look like little crappy companies that are swapping and probably something we should ignore.
Yeah,
I think that's true this time. There's a couple coming up from the 250 that are catching my attention, but Paul?
Nothing on my radar at the minute at all. It's just a, like you say, it's a fight. It's the best of the worst, really, at this point. On the student letting, I'd be very interested to see the numbers and see if the revenue there is growing, see if the cash flow is growing there. But in my experience, particularly of the students in the world now, everything is still online. I suppose though you can't ignore the fact that students will want to get out of their parents' houses regardless of whether they're studying or not. So maybe it's less student flats, it's more just people wanting to get together and start getting out into the world. Very interesting, very, very interesting to see how the world's growing in that. What do
Paul,
you want to
kick us
start
off.
with?
You've been looking at Broadcom. You own Broadcom, I think. How's that been going?
I don't. I had to sell Broadcom when it reached around $700, and I think it dipped again. I had to sell it. What I will say, in fact, let's just get with the numbers first. I've written a few things down, which you'll be proud of me, because I never usually do this. But Broadcom recently had its rise. I think it was 11% on the news that Apple was going to continue its contract with Broadcom to supply the non-smart semiconductors. So the difference between smart and non-smart semiconductors, I'm putting this in layman's terms, is that you have semiconductors which are basically switches. Switches turn on and off. Broadcom makes the most basic versions of that that goes into your smartphones, goes into your Wi-Fi routers, blah blah blah. They simply don't process the information. They simply say turn off and on. So that's the basics of Broadcom. Recently released its results. Revenue 8.75 billion, beat by 25 million. Earnings per share, that's GAAP, $8.15 per share, beat by 14 cents a share. So everything is really good there. But we need to remember that Broadcom is a serial sandbagger. It has beat on estimates for the past 10 years. So I don't really pay much attention to Broadcom beating its earnings and revenue that much, but it always seems to stimulate the market when it does beat. Networking has been strong. So networking being its switches that go into Wi-Fi routers, up. They said management said it's now 15% of their semiconductor business, all to do with what word? AI, of course. Yes, AI was a massive story on this one, and they believe that AI related revenue is now going to increase to 25% of their business by 2024. So this is where the big market push has come from, because they said the word AI like 50 times in their entire thing. The networking entirely has grown 20% this year, due to data centers. So data centers, and this is going to be an important part of AI, I think. I think you may have touched on it last week, but I think the data center is going to become a big story going forward. NVIDIA announced that it needed over $1 trillion spending on data centers. This is all going to benefit the networking, the routers, the power that goes into data centers, and on a small note, REITs maybe, because Nvidia doesn't own too many of its own REITs as far as data networking goes. Biggest story recently is that they have a new deal with Apple. That was one of the main reasons why I sold Broadcom. Mobile phone revenue fell 9%, but it's expected to change, I think, with 20% growth year on year due to the recent Apple deal. That's later in the year. This is going to be a very interesting one, because the whole thesis and the whole risk on Broadcom, and the reason why I don't own it anymore, is that long term, the companies that it supplies its semiconductors to are very easy to make. It's not a tough thing to do. That lowers the moat of Broadcom. It lowers the possibility of the future cash flow as Apple and Google decide that they are going to start making their own semiconductors in-house, if that is cheaper. And that is ultimately the case here, that Google and Apple and Samsung need to see good return on investment in there, if they're going to go in-house. They feel that this is very important in their wafer semiconductors. So that's they feel that there's definitely ROIC in that area, but we don't know if it's in switches yet, and that's where Broadcom is sitting. For me, that's too much of a 50-50 possibility, which is why I don't own Broadcom at the moment. They've also got their VMware acquisition, which is still a 50-50 chance. That's their software thing, which prior to the whole AI thing, software was going to be Broadcom's next biggest thing. That's actually down. It fell in, I think it only grew by 3% this year. So its acquisition of VMware is very, very important towards its software side, which was supposedly its growth driver for this year and the next 10 years. That isn't certain yet, but if you do see the VMware acquisition go through, you're likely to see a good boost in the share price. Long term, I'm not so sure on this one. I've always had a good discount cash flow model of around $650 per share. That's what I would buy it for, a really good return. Turns out I was right, because it's now around $800 a share and it's probably going to continue going up. So right now, no upside for me. I don't see it, but I would have if I had held onto it. And if I still owned it, I would still be holding onto it, definitely. But I just can't see a ridiculous market beating upside at this point.
So I would agree with that to some degree. I think despite mentioning AI on the call an awful lot of times, they then went to project earnings and revenue guidance that showed that they were getting none of the upside that Nvidia was getting from AI. So Nvidia came out and said, next quarter, we're going to grow by 65%. And everybody was like, hell's bells, that's a lot of growth. Well, Broadcom came out and said, well, actually, we're AI and AI and data centers and AI and big trend in AI and data centers, but we're going to grow by 5%. So what they're trying to say there is that essentially they're not getting an awful lot of the kind of growth that Nvidia were talking about. Well, you would say
because
they grew by 8% this quarter. So it might be one of those cases of obfuscation by use of the word AI. But they're they're doing okay in terms of what they are. I mean, at the moment they're at 19 forward PE, even at $812, which is pretty expensive. That's essentially the same PE as the S&P 500. On a forward basis. So, although I still would imagine those things, I still think they're going to get revised down at some point, and Broadcom will look a little bit more expensive than that. But that's not egregious for a company that's up 46% this year to still be only on a 19 forward PE, a 24 current PE. That's not massively expensive. But again, for the sector itself is usually around this kind of price. But look, you're paying a 19 forward PE, 24 current PE for a company that's predicting 5% growth, even sandbagged if they achieve 6-8%. It's not remarkable. It's not really something that I would be really, really chasing now. I think when you were buying this poll in the 300s, I seem to remember when we used to talk about it, I think that was a lot better price than, or was it 300 or 400s? A lot better price than it is today. Evidently, that's one of the stupidest things I've ever said, because evidently buying something at 400 is better than buying 800. But I don't know, Paul. I'd have been tempted to hold on to it from here with an early cost basis.
I think personally, I'm not a seller. First and foremost, so to see it, and I understand, I can see your point definitely. I think these AI revenues are definitely going to get revised down. There's no doubt about that at all. I think though, so this is probably a contrarian kind of opinion, particularly with networking the data centers as far as AI goes. I don't think that the squeeze on these are going to last forever. I think that particularly in the data centers, there is high maintenance capital expenditure. I think there's pricing power in there. With how important these data centers and these networking features and the infrastructure that goes in, I think there's going to be, they're going to simply go to Nvidia and go, you can't have all of the pie. It's we've got to work together here. And I think the prices are going to even out at some point. I don't think the ROIC on data centers and networking are there for Nvidia to invest in it solely on its own. I don't think it is there for Google or Microsoft either. They've been trying this for years and years, and they still aren't able to figure out how to make those parts of the infrastructure, the cloud infrastructure, profitable. So I still think they're going to outsource it. The contrarian opinion is going to be that these companies are able to go to the big tech and say, hey, we need a little bit more margin here because you rely on us, and we're going to need to do it because you pushed us right into the ground. Every single company that is in this area that's supporting the whole cloud and AI network at the moment is on its knees as far as margin goes. And I don't think they can continue in that way and just invest in themselves unless they're trying to squeeze it out. So there's a lot there.
Yeah, I was looking at Digital Realty the other day. So I've been quite following Chernos's short on this. And actually, when you dig into what Chernos says, you can see all of the problems people like Digital Realty have at the moment.
Oh, he's right.
So I was looking at their cash. They've got about $1 billion in cash, and cash equivalents at the moment, but they're burning about $200 million in cash a month. So realistically, they've got, you know, 5 months runway, say, before they need to sell shares and raise cash again. But the heat's on people like Digital Realty now, and they're sort of like, I feel like the cat's about the bag, and I don't know whether people will continue to exchange this perpetual growth for the capex spend that Digital Realty do, and when they're not showing real profitability, they kind of, I don't know, I feel like there's a Michael Lewis book coming on Digital Realty soon and Equinox and how they've kind of cheated their capex spends to basically lie about their profitability. But yeah, I just think if AI is coming, and like I say, that we're going to need hundreds of billions of pounds. The OpenAI founder this week said they're going to need hundreds of billions of pounds spent on data centers. Like, from what we have now, which seems like a lot of data centers, we're going to need hundreds of billions of dollars. Sorry, you would never say pounds. It's an irrelevant currency. Hundreds of billions of dollars more capex spent on these. And you look at the people like Digital Realty and Equinix and think, you guys are screwed. Do you know what I mean? Like, no one's going to give you that amount of money because, I mean, you've been a poor handler of cash in the times that we haven't had to spend this amount.
NVIDIA named Digital Realty in the beneficiary of the $1 trillion that they're putting into data centers. That's why Digital Realty has gone up so much in the past like couple of weeks. But absolutely, the cash burn is definitely a worry at this point.
NVIDIA don't make enough money to give anybody $1 trillion of anything.
Right.
It's just not going to happen. NVIDIA and... Yeah. It's such a lie, isn't it? It really makes me laugh when people promise things like $1 trillion and they're, they barely make a few billion in profit. Like, yeah, well, you're going to go 50 years profit. Are you? Is that what you're going to give them?
It's $1 trillion over 10 years, I think. That's what they deem the investment into data centers and storage is going to be. And like you say, they're not making the profit. So where are they going to do this in a business where it doesn't earn particularly good ROIC at the minute? It's got to change. That's the whole point, is that whole thing has to change somehow. And I don't think anyone really knows which direction that's going to go in. But I will say, very risky to be in data center REITs at the moment. Very, very.
On Broadcom, I think I see everything that you're saying and feel pretty much exactly the opposite way to Steve. We're looking at the same thing, and I think I see a glass half empty where he sees a glass half full, and I think to some extent you do as well, Paul. I actually think when you said you sold this at 700, I looked at it and thought, okay, so you left so far 15% behind, but I think 700 is a really good sale. I would be out at 700 as well based on this. At the kind of price that we're now looking at, I see nothing but risk. I see Apple, who has made it clear that it wants to get Broadcom out of its supply chain several times, and directly it becomes a viable possibility to do that, I think they will, which I think limits Broadcom's ability to try and push prices and take Apple's margins because they'll go away and do it themselves. The reason they're not doing it, I would guess, is that it's too expensive. And if it becomes better on a relative basis because they're going to have to give Broadcom more money, I think they might just raises the chances of them doing it to me. So I'm not sure how much ability Broadcom has to get more out of companies like Apple, or Apple specifically in this case. I also look at them as very much a growth by acquisition company, and that to me looks like a combination of risk and not risk. They tried to acquire Qualcomm ages ago and that didn't work for fun, complicated reasons that we won't get into right now, but I'm torn on what to think about growth by acquisition. If you do it well, it can be really good. And in fairness, I think Broadcom generally has done it pretty well so far.
Yeah,
but there is always, I mean, we don't need particularly to harp on the dangers of overpaying for acquisitions and then what happens to your goodwill and your share price as a result. But sort of 25 times backwards earnings, 19 times forwards. I think this is a kind of lesson in the idea that it's not just about saying, oh, cool, chips AI, and everything's going to kind of win. I think this might be a case where I'm horribly reminded, and not in anything like the same scale, but I'm reminded of the thesis people currently have on Intel, which is basically chips, manufactured chips. There'll be loads of money in chips. Who cares? Because it's chips. No one else really does this thing. No one else really does this thing because the margins are rubbish. And Taiwan Semi is a massive competitor that's hard to compete with. I think if you're in the wrong part of the chip business, I'm not sure the margins look like they're there to me quite. And I'm not convinced that Broadcom is in the right part of it at the moment. So I don't know. I think you might have done the right thing by getting out of there for whatever reason it was you decided to do it. Okay, you could have had another 15% if you sold it today, but that's always the case. Share prices move around and they do stuff and people will be happy about them sometimes and sad about them other times. I think 700 is a good sale.
Shall we do Salesforce?
Let's talk about Salesforce. Tell me about Salesforce, Steve.
Okie doke. So here are the numbers for you. So get your pads ready, everybody at home. Revenue was up to $8.25 billion. That's up 11%. Remaining performance obligations was up 7% to $46.7 billion. Adjusted operating income, Paul's favourite measure, was up to $2.27 billion, plus 74% year-on-year. Adjusted EPS was up a similar amount, 72% to $1.69. That adjusted op margin was up 10 percentage points to 28%, which left you with operating cash flow of about $4.5 billion, a 22% increase, margin of about 54%, which is 485 basis points, Steve, because I know you love it when I swap between percentage point and basis points. Free cash flow, $4.2 billion. Plus 21%, margin was 52%, 432 basis points up. So looking pretty good for them in terms of just the general revenue and cash flow figures. Revenue by geography, America was up 10% to $5.5 billion. Europe was up 17% to $1.9 billion. And APAC was up 24% to $792 million. Pulled an interesting slide out of the earnings guide, Steve. Non-GAAP expense profile. So this includes marketing, sales revenue, cost of revenues, research and development, and general and administrative. And they've basically shown us that's basically since Elliott Management came in and all the others came in and said stop spending money on stupid stuff, Salesforce has reduced their spending profile by about 10%, so from 82% of revenue to 72% of revenue. So looking pretty good, really. The non-GAAP op margin obviously up by a full 10 percentage points. GAAP operating margins up by 4.7 percentage points, but that's still great in terms of what they're doing. In terms of guidance, Q2 revenue was for $8.51 billion to $8.53 billion. The Wall Street wanted $8.49, so it was a pretty handy beat. EPS, they've said $1.89 to $1.90, and Wall Street wanted $1.70, so again, handy beat. And full year revenue, Wall Street wanted $34.63 billion. They said $34.5 to $34.7, so about slap bang in the middle of the midpoint. And EPS, Wall Street one is 714 and they said 741 to 743. So decent figures all around, I thought here, Steve. Guidance was a little bit weak, I guess, if you were going to criticize anything. Earnings were a little bit subdued. But there was $700 million worth of restructuring in here, and you still haven't seen the full effect of the SBC reductions from all of the layoffs that Salesforce has had. So I think the next couple of earnings, you're going to see that true Salesforce earnings power that me and you have spoken about at length over the last sort of three or four quarters. Management tried their best to say AI and machine learning a lot on the call, but it wasn't enough. The market sent it down about 6% overnight, but it's only down about 2% on the week. So again, I think these are the sort of figures that you would expect to kind of 2% fall on the week. Lastly, they said that they've reiterated their goal to be the largest, most profitable enterprise software company in the world. And Steve, they've changed what they classify themselves as. So listen to this statement. As we continue on our path for our long-term goal to make Salesforce the largest, most profitable enterprise software company in the world and the number one safest and most trusted AICRM. How do you feel about that?
Pretty terrible with the idea of an AI CRM. I didn't hear that. I thought they were positioning themselves as a data company was one thing that I read somewhere. One thing question that I had is, are they not the largest enterprise software company in the world? Is that Microsoft then in that case? Does that count as
I'm
a,
sure
I'm
sorry,
you know, I'm not sure how much of Microsoft is enterprise software stuff. But, I mean, so when I think about Salesforce, that's either a really big claim being the largest enterprise software company in the world if you think, okay, we're going hunting Microsoft. Or you think it's not really much of a claim if you think, if you don't include Microsoft, and presumably you don't really include sort of Google above that either as enterprise software, it's not much of a claim in that case. I'm surprised they're not there yet. Salesforce, when I think about this, I think those earnings sound fine to me in terms of the general development of stuff. I'm interested in how the Elliott management dynamic plays out. I'd sort of forgotten they were there, so it's nice to be reminded of that going on. I had a kind of slightly left field idea from Salesforce of what I'd like to see happen, and it has not a lot to do with the company here. I sort of wonder what the effect of a recession on them would be, and I mean a sort of heavier than expected recession. I realise that, Steve, you're not particularly expecting one, and so far you're winning with this bold prediction, but on the one hand, I kind of think a recession would be bad for Salesforce because some of its clients might go broke and therefore not spend any more money with them. But I also sort of think that a number of their competitors might also come under pressure in this and get hoovered up quite easily. So I actually sort of think this is one of those stocks where if I thought there was going to be a deeper than expected recession, which is, which put it that way, might be a recession at all, I wonder whether this might do sneak well, because I wonder whether it might be the case that when you have a kind of ex-industry event, it's the companies with the biggest, strongest, most powerful balance sheets and that kind of thing, and they're pretty good balance sheet-wise, I think, that tend to come out stronger, in a stronger position relative to everyone else than they went in. And this is a thing that I think is going to grow over time, and I wonder whether this might flush out some competition. So I thought in general the earnings were fine and sort of largely what I was expecting, and nothing particularly caused me to pin my ears back here. But I was wondering about what the kind of future looks like in terms of a slowing economic environment, and I wonder whether there might be a buying opportunity coming if things turn down more than people are expecting.
That's a really good way of thinking about it. It's, I mean, it's going to go through the same process as the advertising companies, less spending on things, but CRM is very integral to most things. I'd love to see how an AI CRM deals with. My brain can't figure out any of the uses there. I assume it's going to be a case of,
I'm not sure Salesforce is Kim.
Yeah, well, this is it, right? They've just made some bold claims and gone, well, is it necessary? Do we need someone making it? Something make a decision where it could make the wrong decision at certain times. Very interesting. Economic downturn is definitely where you're going to get that. You might see something like CRM become commodity-like and become cyclical. It'd be very interesting to see how that works. Like you say, it will hoover up a few new clients in that time as well.
They're a bit like ASML in the way that they've got quite a lot of backlog to get through. You know what I mean? So even if there's a big sort of cyclical downturn in business, Salesforce has got like quite a lot of contractual backlog, and that's what I meant by that comparison. Steve's giggling away in the background like it's the worst comparison known to man. But Salesforce is somewhat shielded from a short-term recession because of the fact that they've got about a year and a half's revenue in RPO left. So I don't think that they're in a massive issue short-term. I think you'd have
I think your switching costs sort of and your networking effect are really strong. I think that CRMs are so built in.
And there's a couple of things in here.
Companies these days.
Well, there's a couple of things, Paul, since you were last on the show. But when you were last on the show, Salesforce was a very dilutive company. Now the share count's coming down, which is something that you'll probably like to hear. And the other thing is that we're in a period now where you look at the backwards PE and you look at the forwards PE, and you're seeing the two sales forces, the old sales force and this sales force that it's been forced to be. And I can show you that in terms of figures. PE at the moment is 923. Forward PE is 24. So there you go. We are slap bang in the middle of the two wow. sales forces here. So I think I've said it for the longest time here that Salesforce is just hiding profitability. They could make profitability whenever they wanted to. They just didn't want to. And they were kind of enjoying being like Hawaii as a company. But here we are. Salesforce is showing you that it can be profitable. It's still growing really well. Share count's coming down. Earnings are great. It's making itself more efficient. can't really see what the problem is here. I think this one's still doing fine.
Well, no, I mean, you said it's like ASML, so it's auto-buy, right?
Auto-buy, yeah. I'm going to put it on the ticket behind me. Well, which is... just ran out of battery.
I mean, that's basically what I was noting there. I thought, yeah, any kind of vague ASML kind of comparison, and away we go. It's a sign that people should just buy it all immediately without thinking, because it has an enormous...
AI... Yeah, AI chips, data center, AI CRM. Bye.
AI CRM is sort of fascinating to me. I was listening to Motley Fool on this talking about Salesforce. I think it was Tim Byers covering this one. And they're doing a good job of both kind of adding new people and upselling the people, or adding more modules onto people that they have. And we've always talked about Salesforce's moat as being a switching costs moat, that once you're kind of hooked into that ecosystem, I guess we can call it that, it's hard to kind of change, because it involves kind of uprooting quite a bit, and there's a literal switching cost in terms of retraining people onto various different platforms and so on. I always find with Salesforce, I mean, it's fairly obviously it's a kind of B2B thing, and I always find it's kind of a bit far removed for me. And the more companies use terms like workflow and stuff like that, which as far as I can tell just means things that you're doing, the more I get convinced that I don't know what they are or understand them or what they do, even though I do use Slack and that kind of thing, which is again, that's an interesting sort of thing. Slack, I sort of wonder what the kind of point or why that's anything more than a kind of messaging platform, but there are apparently strong reasons why people really want their stuff to be built in with Slack rather than some other messaging thing. I mean, I also WhatsApp my colleagues as well, so it's a company I struggle to get a bit, but I find it hard to argue that in on paper, in kind of numbers, in theory, I really ought to be kind of interested in this. Forward PE of 24. That means earnings growth of, I can't even count how much percent, Steve.
A lot.
I think that's enough.
Any last
on that
thoughts?
What have we got next?
Okay, let's talk about Guidewire then, which is more CRM stuff, but this time it's kind of specialist CRM. It's like Salesforce in that it is a CRM company, and it's like Broadcom in that one of us used to own it and we don't anymore. So I've sold this. So here's, let's start with the stock rather than the business. I know we watch businesses, not stocks, but in the aftermath of their earnings report, the following analysts either raised or reaffirmed their buy ratings, price targets, and so on and so forth. They were RBC Capital, Stifel, Wells Fargo, Jefferies, Needham, and Oppenheimer. Those were the only ones that I actually saw having any kind of rating on it at all. And all of them said price target up, basically. So naturally, the stock went down 15% immediately afterwards. And I couldn't work out quite what people were seeing here. So Guidewire, before we get into the numbers, here's the basic idea of what's going on. It's an insurance company CRM, so it's a specialist in CRMs. They have the biggest share by a long way. They are incredibly sticky. As I understand it, they have never lost a customer to a competitor, not that they have that many. But what they run is a load of online platforms for stuff like policy management and claims handling and all that kind of stuff that you associate with insurers specifically. And what they're doing at the moment is trying to get as many people signed up for their subscription cloud-based stuff rather than kind of license-style model that they used to be on. In the quarter, they added 8 new deals, which is, they already have about 25%, I think, of all the premiums written by anybody. 8 new deals is helpful here, but revenue was $207.5 million, which was up by about 5% from a year ago. Subscription revenue, the one that they're kind of targeting and trying to move people towards, was up 24%. Services revenue down 13%, and license revenue down 6%. They're trying to kind of move people across from there, so I guess that's not a massive surprise. Annual recurring revenue is $722 million, up from $664. So moving in the right direction. $722 million on quarterly revenue of $207.5, because we're sort of thinking for the year on recurring revenue, which has initially just caused me to think for a moment. Company loses money. Company makes a GAAP loss of around $57.8 million. They used to be losing $62.4 million. They adjust that loss, because why wouldn't you, to about $12 million versus sort of $24 million. I adjust that loss in my head to compute that they make a non-GAAP operating profit of $826 trillion, because AI, and why not, I've adjusted it in Parik Patel sort of style. If you're a gap losing company, though, you do need to be aware a little bit on burning cash and how quickly you're going to run out of it, in the style of some of those companies we were talking about earlier. So they currently have 806.9 million in cash, and over the last 9 months, this was their Q3 report, so year to date, as it were, for three quarters, they've used about 135, so they've got about five-ish, maybe, years worth of cash ahead of them. I don't see an immediate issue there. However, they might not have 5 years worth of cash left ahead of them because they keep using that cash to do buybacks with. So over the last, I think probably about the quarter or so, they spent around, I was looking at it, they bought in 3.2-ish million shares at $61, so about 200 million's worth of buyback there. I worked that out to be another 207,000 at $77, and that's around 16 million, so about 216 million worth of buyback, and there's still 184 million worth of buyback left on their current agreed buyback plan. The first bit I mentioned, the big 200 bit, was an accelerated plan because their stock went through the floor because interest rates started going up, so they thought, great, let's go buy them. They then offered some guidance, and I don't really know why, because if your company is losing money and expecting to lose money, what the hell do you care about what the next quarter looks like, as long as it's not completely insane? I don't think anyone owns this stock because they think, next quarter, we are going to make mad bank. But they're guiding for annual recurring revenue, 745 to 755, revenue of 255 to 265. And an operating loss or profit of between minus 7 and 3. Plus 3 million, depending on where that comes out. Guidance for the rest of the year, for the full year, was 745 to 755, so same annual recurring revenue. Revenues of 890 to 900 million, operating loss of between 163 and 153 million, both on the losing side. I don't know why anyone's looking at guidance for this company. You're not planning on making it. Why are they thinking they're going to pay a dividend? They might do. They do buybacks with it. So they have a load of cash lying around because they have a lot of cash kind of pulled forward. They are a kind of company that gets money in and then provides a service going out over time. So I was trying to work out what I think of them buying back stock. I kind of like it, I think. Certainly when it was around 60-odd dollars a share, I sold this thing at around 70-odd dollars. In fact, no, I sold it at around 77 dollars a share, which means that some of this buyback stuff they've done might have been me. I might have sold them part of this buyback thing. It's now down to about 70 again, which I sort of think is kind of about right. If you're wanting a cash today business, it's not that. If you're wanting a cash tomorrow business, it's probably not that either. If you're wanting a cash next year business, it's not that either. If you want a cash in sort of 10 years or so business, this could be really interesting. They have a really, really strong market position. They have a nice business model. I think they're working quite well. Market did not like this at all and sent them down 15% on the day, recovered a little bit since. But I'm kind of tempted back into this, to be honest.
Yeah, I can see why. I mean, you can see, just looking at their historic figures here, you can see when they turned off the idea of selling a license and turned on to selling subscriptions, because their free cash flow per share absolutely disappeared. They were doing $1.76 in free cash flow in 2017. Now they're losing about 78 cents. So it's a big swing around, which is probably why they think that they can buy back shares, because they think this loss-making period is probably going to be fairly short-lived. Once everybody gets over to subscriptions and they continue to grow from that, that the free cash flow per share will return. So it is nice to see in a company like this. I mean, it's not growing at any kind of rapid pace, but you can see here that their shares outstanding in 2019 was about 81 million. It's 83 million now, but that's actually down from the last couple of years where it's been 84. So it is nice to see that on a company that's growing, you know, 15-20% or whatever it is, that shares outstanding aren't going up with it, especially while it's loss making. Although there's not a lot of shares outstanding there either, Steve. It's only a 5.7 billion market cap. If you think that they're going to do potentially a billion in earnings this year, or somewhere near a billion in revenue, sorry, this year, it's not a particularly egregiously priced company. I think it might be one of those kind of under the radar stocks that could do quite well for you moving forward.
Yeah, I don't understand why it's not on more people's radars. Not because I think it's an amazing world-beating thing, but I think it looks like a lot of things are on a lot of people's radars. It looks a lot like the kind of tech companies that were popular in 2020, say. And a lot of people have stuck with those, and we're about to demonstrate that we've stuck with some of those, as we tell you about like five of them in one sentence in a minute. But I'm sort of not sure quite why Guidewire didn't catch the attention of people like that, but I'm kind of happy that it didn't. I think seriously about... Paul talked earlier about the kind of run that big tech has been on, and it's got me looking at them and thinking about them in some cases, not because I think they're desperately overvalued just yet, but I look at my Apple investment and think it might be close to fully valued at the moment. I'm not Warren Buffett. I can get out of this without enormous tax implications. Where might I go after that? Don't know. Maybe somewhere like Guidewire. I'm not saying I will, and I'm not saying it's likely in the near future, but I do also, the way I'm going, I do also have a sizable Forterra dividend coming, which will need to go somewhere. That's a candidate place, I suppose. Okay, Steve, that's enough about Guidewire for the moment. Tell us about another five companies that look a lot like Guidewire, but are not Guidewire.
Okay, here's your five in five. So we'll start with Zscaler. Can't remember what this company does, something to do with security or something or other. But revenue was up 46% to $419 million. The customer spending over 100K was up 29% to 2,432. Adjusted operating income, because why not? Let's just adjust everything. Was 135%. Up 135% year on year to $64 million. Adjusted EPS followed it, up 182% year on year to 48 cents. Adjusted operating margin grew from 9% to 15%. SBC as a percentage of revenue actually fell 10 percentage points, so it fell from 37 to 27, so that's always nice to see. Operating cash flow, Steve, 108 million. That was plus 40%. Margin of about 26%. That was actually down a little bit. Free cash flow, 74 million, plus 69%. Margin was about 18%, which is up 239 basis points. In terms of guidance, they said 429 to 431. Wall Street wanted 427. EPS, they said about 49. That's adjusted, 49 cents. Wall Street wanted 47. And full year, they said 1.591 to 1.593 billion, very accurate. And Wall Street wanted 1.581, so about 10 million beat or something like that. And full year EPS, they said 163 to 164, again adjusted. The estimate was 156. Market really liked this one. It was up about 11% on the week. I think there's a lot to like in this report. Zscaler is probably shocking Paul how big it's managed to get since the last time he was actually probably on the show for more than 2 minutes. I will quickly rattle through the others, Paul, because I'll just quickly squeeze these two in. But CrowdStrike and Sentinel, well, I'm going to do them together because they're the same sort of company. They're doing the same thing. This is both their Q1 2024. CrowdStrike revenue was up massive. It was up 42%. During these conditions, that's great. It was up to $693 million. Annual revenue rate was up 42% to $2.73 billion. Adjusted op income was up 40% to $116 million. Adjusted EPS was up 84% to 57 cents. Op margins remained steady at about 17%. Obviously, they're adjusted as well. Operating cash flow, $301 million, plus 40%. Margin, 43%. That was down a little bit in terms of margin. Free cash flow, $227 million, up 44%. Margin was 33%, up 55 basis points. Stock-based comp as a percentage of sales, which is my new favourite metric for everybody, was 19, down from 21. So that's good as well. It's coming down. It's still high, but it's coming down. Stock fell about 10% overnight. They actually made it back all later in the next trading day. CrowdStrike actually achieved GAAP profitability in this quarter, but they were actually shocked by this on the call and said, don't expect it to be like this forever. It's going to go negative as soon as next quarter. Really funnily, they said that they were basically asked a question about how they compete against SentinelOne and Microsoft, and they just disregarded the whole comparison to SentinelOne and just said 8 out of 10 times when an enterprise customer test, they choose CrowdStrike over Microsoft, and our win rates across all competitors were strong in the quarter. And I'll quickly do SentinelOne and I'll open it up for comment. So SentinelOne, their revenue was up 71%, but to $133 million, much smaller base. Customers over spending over 100K was plus 61% to 916. Adjusted operating income was up 11%, but it's still minus $51 million, so they're adjusting it to a still negative figure, which is always an interesting thing to do. Adjusted EPS was up 29%, but that's still minus 15 cents. Adjusted operating margin, get ready for this, fellas, minus 74%. They've managed to raise it up to minus 38%. So that's a big swing, but it's laughably bad when you're adjusting from minus 74% to minus 38%. I mean, what is the point of adjusting if you're saying we're still terrible? SBC moved from 41% of revenue to 42% of revenue. That's the wrong direction, and it's far too high. This is a company, like, clearly ran for its employees, and the market rewarded it as it should do. It was down 33%. It fell another 10 or 12% the next day as well. And when you add to this that a number of their executives have defected to rival CrowdStrike, you can see this company probably isn't in the best of shape. I don't have really anything more on SentinelOne. I think it's a bit of a shit cone.
We spoke about this over a year ago, that CrowdStrike...
Yeah, we do that, Paul. They do earnings every quarter.
No, we saw this dissipation between CrowdStrike going like... I think there's definitely... opportunity here in between, because this is a business that's very hard to understand. This is a business where if you're not involved in this, you won't see the ins and outs of this going day to day. And I think half of the market here, half of the investors into this, what they thought was a duopoly at one point, they were thought this was really going to become a duopoly between CrowdStrike and the other company that my head's gone now. I think that SentinelOne they've been completely crushed, and I think that half of the market there is going to learn a lesson. I think they're going to learn a lesson in really understand what you're earning here, and now start to move yourself over to CrowdStrike and Microsoft and see what's going to do better in this place.
I'm genuinely unsure what the other company Paul was thinking of. As such is like my knowledge of this space, it might have been Palo Alto Networks, because they're a cybersecurity company. They're quite big. People talk about them a lot. That's pretty much the limit of my kind of competence in this area. So here's how I think about CrowdStrike. It's down again, as you saw. Revenue's up sort of about 45%, you were saying, over the year. And stock-based comp as a percentage of revenue came down by 2%, which tells me they're still flinging stock-based comp around fairly well, just the revenue's going up faster. Fine, in that case, I guess. When I look at CrowdStrike, then, I don't want to go all Cathie Wood, but she was talking about Zoom the other week and saying, look, it's about, I don't know, at a guess, half the price it was in 2020 when people wanted to buy it then, and it makes a lot more money now than it did then. CrowdStrike at least brings in a lot more money through the front door. It doesn't make any money at all, from what I can tell. Or, well, it makes money by accident and then attempts to course correct this by not making any money in the future. But it's now just over half the price it was back in 2021. It's not quite halved, but including with that most recent drop, it has a market cap of around 35 billion, I was seeing. And the way I would think about this then is, okay, here's some other companies with 35 billion market caps. Which ones do you think will make more or less money than CrowdStrike in the next 10 years? So Lennar has a 36 billion market cap. That's quite cyclical, obviously. Kroger has a 34 billion market cap. That's not very cyclical. Welltower has a 37 billion market cap. That has a sort of tailwind from an aging population, but is a REIT and therefore struggles to grow at all. And Newmont, which is a gold miner, has a market cap of 33 billion. So which of those is going to make more money than CrowdStrike over the next 10 years? And the honest answer is, I don't know. Can I imagine those, by the way, all have free cash flows. Some of them are more cyclical, so they're kind of variable, right? But they're around the 1.5 to 2 billion mark if you try and average them out. Will CrowdStrike do better than that in the next 10 years? Maybe. I definitely don't think it's crazy to think it's doing that. It just grew its revenues at 45%. So when that turns into free cash flows, it might kind of get there. I tried to do some kind of very quick maths and thought if they grow at around 15% per year revenue and pick out a free cash margin of about 18 to 20%, that gets you to somewhere like where these guys might go with significantly lower growth rates or choppier things like that. The trouble is, I don't necessarily know that CrowdStrike's going to be the winner in all of this, which leads me towards picking an ETF, Jason Moser style, for cybersecurity. But I also don't know that I think any of those are going to make enough to kind of justify their market cap. I looked at an ETF, and it had a lot of interesting stuff in it. It had Palo Alto, then Cisco Systems, then Accenture, then CrowdStrike, then Cloudflare. So that's a real mix of Cisco, which is quite old as a company now, Accenture, which is established, and three that are, in theory, on the way up. So I am completely lost in this space, and hopefully I give you some more idea about why, I guess.
I can give you a little bit more info, Steve. That might sway or not sway your opinion. The analysts actually disbelieved George Kurtz, the CEO of CrowdStrike. They actually slapped a forward PE of 49 on average. So they actually think that this thing, you know, at least in the next year, is going to keep its gap profitability at least a decent level. So I mean, this one's down a half from its high. It was a $300 stock during the pandemic craziness, and it's now a $151 stock. So I don't think that's too bad. A forward PE of 49, growing at 42%. Those numbers all seem fine to me, especially for a company that's not trying to show its profitability at the moment, and maybe can't flex profitability in the way that Salesforce always can. But I don't think it's a billion miles away from being able to flex profitable muscles growing at 42%. There comes a point, an inflection point, where companies have more cash than they can waste on R&D and stock-based compensation. And I don't think CrowdStrike is a million miles away from that. Is it a $35 billion company at the moment? No, but it's growing at 42%. It could be.
Through a recession, it's going to be one of those companies that is not going to be got rid of. No one's getting rid of security during a recession. In fact, that's the point where you're going to increase your security. So I think it has a bit of a cyclicality proof kind of business model here. So there's potential. Like I said, I'm with Steve W on this one. Complicated market, which we don't understand.
Right, shall I just quickly rattle through Okta and MongoDB?
Yep.
Right, okay. Last two in the SaaS leagues for you then. So Okta, they're also time travelers. This is their Q1 2024. Revenue for them was up 25% to $518 million. RPO, remaining performance obligation, was up 9% to $2.94 billion. Adjusted op income was up 190% to $37 million. Adjusted EPS was up 181% to 22 cents. Adjusted op margin rose from minus 10% to plus 7%, so a big 17% swing. Operating cash flow, $129 million. That was up 579%. Margin was up to 25%. That's a 2,033 basis point swing, Steve. Free cash flow was $124 million. That's plus 1,027%. So a bit of a 10x there for you. Margin was 24%. That was up 2,129 basis points. Big fall in stock-based compensation as a percentage of revenue. That went from 41% of revenue to 32% of revenue. It's still too high, but it is nice again to see it dropping in that direction. Okta fell about 25% overnight, and I thought, my only comment on that was a nice leaving present for Chris Hill as he left the Motley Fool on Tuesday. MongoDB, I'll just quickly rattle through this and then again open it up to comments. So MongoDB, I own this one. I'm up a lot on this one. Revenue was up 29% to $368 million. Customer spending over $100K was up 28% to $1,761. Adjusted op income was up 151% to $44 million. Adjusted EPS was up 180% to 56 cents. Adjusted op margin doubled from 6 to 12. SBC as a percentage of revenue down to 28% from 29. And then your free cash flow metrics was $52 million plus 513%, margin 14%. That margin grew by about 11%. And the guidance was... Q2 2024 EPS was, they said they'd be about 43 cents to 46 cents. Wall Street was only expecting 14 cents, so three times what Wall Street was expecting. Q2 revenue was between 388 and 392. Wall Street thought it was going to be 361. So they're implying 29% growth again. Full year EPS, they said it'll be about $1.42 to $1.56. Wall Street was only expecting a dollar, so again, a 50% beat in terms of what Wall Street expected. And full year 2024 revenue, they said $1.522 billion to $1.524 billion. Wall Street thought $1.51. So this represents, again, about 20% growth. I'll just quickly give you some stats that I pulled out. So MongoDB's key product, the one that you keep your eye on, is called Atlas. It's grew at about 40% year on year. It's about 65% of revenue now, which is about plus 5 percentage points. There's about 43,000 customers using it. That's up 22% year on year. Now, this product is slightly dilutive to margins just because of the way that MongoDB are trying to incentivize people to go over to Atlas because it's a better product. They think it, once people get onto Atlas, it'll be more sticky. So if you see those margins coming back up to represent MongoDB's other products, then you're going to get even better profitability across the line. So the market loved this report, sent it up 32.5% this week. It's up 72.5% on the month. And like I say, I'm up about 155% on this one. So I'm very, very happy with it.
Yeah, I had a look at its chart from the week after these earnings and compare that with Okta, which I didn't see much to sort of wildly dislike about Okta. I missed the kind of the reason that things were going bad. I got distracted by these 1,027% growth rates in free cash flow and people thinking, oh, that's not good enough. I'll sell that by sort of 25% or so. Okta is what it is, as far as I can tell. I didn't see anything that was kind of wildly different about them this time. What am I missing there, Steve?
Nothing really. I didn't see anything in there that was a real problem with Okta's results. I mean, I guess you could point out that their revenue has slowed quite a bit to 25% growth now. But again, I don't think that's anything to be sniffed at. Okta's a little bit different to the other companies. I don't think that is as recession-proof as the other parts of the business. Okta essentially is identity protection and it's kind of logon software, I guess, isn't it, is the best way of explaining it. And when you were talking about systems that when in the office, you know, whether in a controlled environment, when you were taking PCs home to work from home, Okta was really great because it meant that, you know, you were protecting your IP as a business, even though, you know, the fact that the employee could log in from home to a work PC, you could be assured that it was that person who was logging in and not, you know, not some competitor who's stolen your employee's computer, I guess. But that's not the case anymore. As work from home, people begin to come back to the office, you should see Okta's revenue grow. That's what we're seeing. They had a hell of a lot of growth pulled forward. It was a very unique situation for Okta. But on the flip side, they're still growing at 25%, and that's not to be sniffed at. I think, to be fair, I think all of these companies, bar SentinelOne, are doing fantastically well. The market has said to them, show us something. Show us that you can make cash. It knocked all of these companies down to pretty low prices and said, prove to us that you have a modicum of profitability. And I think all of these people now, taking their free cash flow metrics and their operating cash flow metrics and saying, well, here it is. We can make money. We're just choosing not to. All of these companies now are self-sustaining, whether you want to buy them or not, because they're diluting you so much with stock-based compensation is a completely different argument. But all of these companies, they're not going away now unless something materially happens to their business, which I don't foresee.
Yeah, rising interest rates were always going to involve some of the companies that were just speculative. I always think of kind of more speculative EV companies, I guess. And I noticed that one of my favourites, Lucid Motors, appears to be going down again this week. Rising interest rates were always going to flush out companies that were sort of not really there and just got a boost off of really high liquidity during the pandemic. But yeah, it seems like a fair point that most of these are looking like they might stay the course. I mean, maybe the Salesforce thought that I had here is applying to sort of these guys as well, right? I mean, when pressure comes on, the strong get stronger and they hoover up the weaker players here, or will they go out of existence?
I think that's what we're going to see, Steve. I'm amazed that we haven't seen the more deep-pocketed members of the S&P 500 going out and hoovering up companies. I mean, I know we've seen a lot of private equity buying up people here and there, but I was expecting some of these companies like your CrowdStrikes and your Octas, I thought some big companies would be swiping in and picking them up when they were in their pandemic lows. It was disappointing time, if anything, for M&A during that period. There was a lot of tech stocks that got infinitely cheaper, and it seems like greed sat in and CEOs were waiting for even cheaper prices rather than just buying. You'd have done fantastically well buying CrowdStrike in the lows, and I think you'd done fantastically well in the future as well. So real shame.
Yeah, in fairness to some of these deeper pocketed, let's take Google as an example for the moment, companies, then a lot of those five that you talked about, plus Guidewire, not really Salesforce, they're too big, they're all down on a result of these kind of earnings things. I sort of wonder whether they might get another go here if stocks just keep kind of falling on the basis of what look to us to be okay reports. I wonder whether they might still find a moment.
On the acquisition deal, I think these acquisitions would look a lot better as they have shown profitability, especially in their operating margins. These would start to look better in big tech companies. There wouldn't be as much psychology around these companies as far as people being the fear and greed. All they would do on the balance sheet of, let's say, Microsoft would go, whoa, this part of Microsoft is now growing quicker than Azure. Like, it would just look far better inside a company. So I think you've got a really good point there.
Fair enough. Wrap us up, Steve.
Cool. Well, that's our show. We've been talking about all kinds of things. It's nice to have all three of us here. I've got a broken finger, so my attempts at writing down Steve D's numbers were basically futile. But if you want to track things back and have another listen, then go right ahead. Thanks for listening, and we will see you all next week.